speaking to Padma here. Now I have resolved all my doubts simply by meeting you. For your lordship has very kindly and clearly explained the duty of a king who desires to protect his subjects. So, Swami Ramana is showing his gratitude. Particularly in this statement, his gratitude for getting some good advice from the learned Brahman. Kardama had congratulated Manu first for his very competent protecting the kingdom, protecting the pious citizens and punishing the impious. That's the glory of the Kshatriya. That's the protecting the pious citizens and punishing the impious. That's the glory of the Kshatriya. That's the contribution to society of the Kshatriya, protection. Of course, everybody does some protecting. Anyone who's a parent protects his children. We discuss how the Brahmins are protecting the principles of religion. Kshatriyas protect the human beings, all the human beings, including the Brahmins, especially those who need protection, who can't defend themselves. So there are certain classes of people in human society always who are defenseless. The women, old people, children, and the Brahmins. Brahmins because they've forsaken violence, so therefore they don't defend themselves. They don't collect money, they don't build fortresses for themselves. So in that way they're voluntarily defenseless. And the others, the women, children, old people, they're helplessly defenseless, involuntarily. The Kshatriya has to defend, protect, especially those helpless persons in society. Even the Vaishyas, they're also engaged in protecting. They protect especially the animals. And they safeguard the wealth of the kingdom. They take care of the economy, so they're protecting the economy. Manage it properly. So everybody, except for the Shudras, they don't take any such responsibility, but all the initiated members of society, the twice-born, they all are engaged in protection, but especially the Kshatriya. All the human beings depend on the protection of the king and of the royal class. So that's the contribution of the Kshatriya, but the even more valuable contribution of the Brahman is his teaching, his instructions. Now, actually, it's been a very short encounter. How much instruction has Kardama given? He's only said a few sentences. And what he said is pretty simple and obvious. But the king, you're the king, you're going around to protect your kingdom. And if you didn't do this, then the criminal elements would be unchecked. That's the most obvious thing. Anybody who has any concept of the Vedic system of social organization can say that. Any child who studied Bhagavad Gita and has any idea what it means can tell you that. So such a simple, obvious, maybe trite instruction that he's given. Still, Manu is grateful. honestly grateful. He's not just flattering. He's honestly feeling this, that his life is greatly improved by hearing even these very obvious statements that he already knows theoretically. When you hear even an obvious truth spoken by a person with clear intelligence, with a pure heart, then it has potency. It will raise your consciousness, even if you've heard it a million times before. The same words, the same idea. It's more important than what you know is who you know. That's what I'm saying. In this sense, meaning that you may know the facts theoretically, but when you hear them from a person with brahminical potency or with spiritual potency, then it goes to your heart. Then it actually clarifies your intelligence effectively. This is actually explained by modern philosophers, at least in one department of philosophy called hermeneutics. You may know of the Karmamimamsa school of Jaimini Rishi. Krishna takes the role of a Karmamimamsa philosopher in the Govardhan Lila. He argues with his father. So this ancient philosophy was taught by Jaimini Rishi, one of the prominent disciples of Vyasadeva. And in that philosophy, the techniques of how to understand the meaning of the Vedas is given. It's a science or a technique of how to interpret the statements of the Vedas, the mantras. You know, the process is, the Vedic process is to hear, to accept information given to you by authority. But you still have to use your senses. If you don't use it, if you don't have any sensory perception, you can't hear. If you don't have an ear that's working and a brain that's working, how can you hear anything, even from an authority? And you also have to have some intelligence. How do you know what the words, you hear the words that go on your ear, but how do you know what the words mean? Unless your intelligence is operating. So the Mimamsa school, they have their metaphysics, they have their view of the universe, it's not exactly the same as ours. They don't believe in the value of liberation. They think we just stay in this world forever, and the goal of life is just to improve your situation in this world. So it's not our worldview that they teach. But they teach a very useful technique how to understand the meaning of the Vedic statements. A technique of interpretation, rules of how to understand what the words mean. Like, for example, Kapinja life, alabeta, one injunction in the Brahmanas, explaining how to perform a sacrifice. I don't know which sacrifice. That you should offer an oblation with pigeons. You have to offer pigeons. As an animal sacrifice or a bird sacrifice. But it just says pigeons, plural. How many pigeons? Now, how many should I get? Should I get 100? Should I get 2? So, Jaimini Rishi explains, when the plural is given and not specified how many, assume it's 3. This is a rule. You know, so therefore, everybody who performs a sacrifice who studied Jaimini knows that when you have to offer the pigeons, you offer 3 pigeons. But whenever the number is plural but not specified, it's 3. It's a rule how to interpret statements that are vague, that are not completely clear. So the whole science of hermeneutics. Hermeneutics is in the West, biblical scholars and philosophers working with them developed a Western version of hermeneutics. How to understand the statements of scripture and also of literature. You know, Shakespeare or somebody wrote a book, you know, wrote his plays almost 500 years ago. The language has changed. And the culture has changed. How do we understand what Shakespeare meant when he wrote these plays? What his purpose and what his meanings were? So you've got to trace the history of the words and try to figure out how Shakespeare was thinking back, you know, understand his culture and his whole environment. The whole science of hermeneutics. So, in this science, they've come up with some, in the Western version of hermeneutics, they've come up with some good ideas. They explain, going back to the biblical traditions, that translation, active translation is very important. Interpreting means to translate. Like Shakespeare wrote 500 years ago, how do we know what he means? We have to translate it into modern thought.
So there's different kinds of translation. One kind of translation is when you change something into a different language. It's obviously what you call a translation. Shakespeare wrote his plays in English and we translate them into Spanish or into Sanskrit. It's been done. I've seen a translation of Venetia Vanik, The Merchant of Venice, in Sanskrit. Anyway, that's the most obvious kind of translation. You're changing from one language to another. But suppose we try to explain what Shakespeare was saying to a modern audience in the same language. We translate in time from an old piece of literature or scripture, try to present it to the modern audience. That's also a kind of translation. We just move it up in time into a different worldview. Third kind of translation, which goes back to the biblical tradition. If you simply repeat the words and just speak a sacred text without changing one word, that's also an act of translation. Yeah. It's a little hard to understand how that's a translation, how anything's changed. But when you're dealing with spiritual sound, just speaking it is an act of interpretation. Can you think of an example? Well, okay. Yes, but Bhagavad Gita we have Bhagavad Gita spoken by Krishna himself. The original spoken by Krishna. It wasn't re-spoken. I'm thinking of the Bhagavatam. Okay? Nigama kalpa taro galitam palam shuka mukad amritu dravya samitam. The Bhagavatam is the ripened fruit of all the Vedic desire tree, the Vedic literatures. And having touched the lips of the transcendental parrot, Shuka means parrot, Shukadev Goswami, having touched his lips, this fruit has become even more juicy and relishable. It's been enhanced. Shukadev Goswami spoke the Bhagavatam. He didn't change one word. He just spoke it verbatim. But that's a very significant act of translation. It says that the Bhagavatam has become much more relishable. That means meaning has been added to it. That you take a transcendentally potent literature and it's simply spoken without any change by a person with transcendentally potent intelligence. His intelligence is added to the message somehow or other. It's a mystical process. But it's an act of translation, of adding to the meaning, making it more understandable. Somehow, Shukadev speaks the Bhagavatam, it's more relishable, more significant. Even though he didn't change one syllable of it. That's stated there in the Bhagavatam itself. By being touched by his lips, it's like a fruit that's been pecked by a parrot. The parrot pokes a hole in the fruit, and then it oxidizes faster, and it becomes sweet while still on the tree. Similarly, here is Kardava Muni. He hasn't spoken 18,000 verses. He's spoken two or three, four or five verses, maybe. And he said things that everybody's heard before. Anybody who knows anything about what the duties of a king are in the Vedic system, it's all old news. But when Kardava, with his pure intelligence and pure heart, when he speaks those same words, Manu considers them very enlightening. He's honestly grateful to hear this, to hear these obvious things from the lips of Kardava. It clarifies, it clears up his intelligence. So the Kshatriya needs to hear this. He needs to hear the cool-headed statements of the Brahmins. He needs to have his intelligence regulated by hearing from the Brahmins, whose intelligence is clearer than his. Even if he simply hears things he knows already, that he's heard before many times, it doesn't matter. He should go to the Brahmins and hear from them, even just to verify what he already knows. But when they verify it, then he can be sure it's true. So therefore,
Swayambhu was saying, yes, thank you. All my doubts are resolved. Even though what you're saying is what everybody already knows, and I've heard it a million times. Thank you, you resolved all my doubts. And he means it. You kindly explained the duties of a king who desires to protect the citizens. If someone's actually a Kshatriya, he's sitting on the throne not just for his own aggrandizement, to fill his own pockets with gold, or just to acquire power because he has an obsession with power. But if he's actually sitting on the throne with the sincere interest to serve the citizens, then he needs to hear his duties explained by the Brahmins every day. Not just, you know, go to school and pass a test and get a king, you know, a king's diploma, and then you can put it on the wall and practice kingship. You have to go back and hear from the Brahmins every day. It's described how Yudhishthira every morning would get up. Guru Vandanaya. First he'd go offer respects to his mother, his mother and father, but to Dhritarashtra and Gandhari, who are his elders. And then he'd go to worship the Brahmins, second business of the day. And we know that a pious king like Yudhishthira, he always consulted the Brahmins on a daily basis, even though he was smart enough himself to know what to do. Okay, any questions or comments? Yes, ma'am. Is that heard by everybody? You know, in the ISKCON situation, how do we apply? If someone has Kshatriya tendencies and then he's put in the position of a GVC or a temple president, how does he function as a Kshatriya? Well, we're learning that to function as a Kshatriya is not just enough to be sitting on the throne. It's not just enough to have the tendencies, the capacity to be a Kshatriya. You need at least two minimal requirements beside that. Beside the qualities and the power in your hands, you've got to have thorough training, and you have to have support of Brahmins, ongoing support. Not just that they educated you, but you need their support on a daily basis. So, unless we can provide devotees who are functioning purely as Brahmins, not just smart devotees who are also caught up in management, who've been pushed into management, but devotees who are able to keep themselves aloof from the managing and just function as Brahmins, then nobody can function as Kshatriya. With all the potential and all the power, they can't actually be working as Kshatriyas. So you're opening up a question. You know, actually I wanted to, even today, open up for, you know, everyone to try to come up with ideas. How does this all apply to ISKCON? Well, you know, we're pretty much wrapping up the philosophical portion here. We can read more of this 22nd chapter, but the philosophy pretty much ends with these few verses. And we can read about how Kartama gets married. And we could also read, there's more to read about how first Manu and then Kartama himself, how they achieved ultimate perfection. But the topic of the course is the encounter between the two, and we're pretty much wrapping that up now. So it can take some time, even a few days, if everyone's interested, to try to discuss. I can't just give you, you know, the answers. I'd like to, we have to investigate. How does any of this apply to ISKCON? This is the eternal Vedic system. This is how a human society is supposed to be set up. And we have instructions from our acharyas, from Prabhupada and his predecessors, that we have to do this. We have to revive the ancient system of social organization, even inside our own spiritual organization. So how can this be done? How can it be done? In what way is it? What form is it supposed to be instituted? Yeah, I wasn't going to start yet,
maybe, you know, after a couple of another two verses, then we can get it to think about it. Yeah.
Can I say that Vaishnava also be a believer for the sake of mission?
Yes.
Should we be
believers? I'm sorry, catch the word.
Belligerent?
I'm sorry, it's just, you know, the problem is that there's noise coming from outside. Maybe just close the door. Yeah.
Polyvalent.
Yeah. Means you occupy more than one position?
Yes. I mean, can you switch spots?
That's what we're trying to do, and it's not working. You know, we have leaders who have to be Brahmins, Kshatriyas, and Vaishyas at the same time. They're the gurus, initiating gurus. They're also, you know, responsible to manage whole continents. And also manage the money, the people and the money. So, you know, they have to take the responsibilities of Vaishya function simultaneously in three different contrary modes. You know, the interests of a Vaishya is to make a profit. The interest of a Kshatriya is to protect the citizens, you know, even exerting violence. The interest of a Brahmin is to teach Dharma and be nonviolent. How can you be, unless you're, you know, mystic, Paramahamsa, how can you be all three at once? It's enough to drive anybody crazy. And so I don't think polyvalency is what we should have. It's what we do have, and that's our problem. Being all three at once. You know, and sometimes the GBC also has to take out the garbage, but he's also acting as a Shudra. You know, he has to clean up because nobody else will clean up. Anyway, let's cover the other two verses. And then I have one interesting quotation from the Manu Samhita, and then we can start our, not a debate, but just a workshop on the question of what is the relevance of this ISKCON right now, and in what, you know, what form can this take practically? Question is, does anything need to be done? Can anything be done, and what is it that needs to be done? But let's look at verse 6 first. Okay. Dishyame Bhagavan Vishto Dudashoyo Kritatmanam Dishya Padarajat Spishtam Shishname Bhagavat Shivam. It is my good fortune that I've been able to see you, for you cannot easily be seen by persons who have not subdued the mind or controlled the senses. I am all the more fortunate to have touched with my head the blessed dust of your feet. So now he's worshiping Karnama. He's thankful to put the dust of Kartima's feet on his head. So unless you're just trying to flatter somebody or you're a hypocrite, these are serious words. If you mean it, then you're accepting that the other person is vastly superior to you and that he deserves your worship. Prabhupada talks about a class of people in India, especially Bengal, Dandavadis, you know, who are constantly falling on the ground flat like a rod, but to manipulate other people. Yeah. So, you know, if you start a riot in Bengal, best thing to do is fall on the ground, offer obeisances. Maybe everybody else will stop fighting and offer obeisances too. But that's just a technique for manipulating people. Yeah. If someone who's honest talks like this, it's a serious matter. It means that you accept the other person as your master. You don't put just anybody's dust on your feet. Anybody's dust from their feet on your head. But he's saying, and he means it, that he's grateful. It's my great good fortune. First of all, that I've been able to see you. You know, yes, you've given me your instructions, but, you know, I don't even deserve, materialist like me, Manu's thinking of himself, doesn't even deserve to see a pure soul like you. To have your association. Because those who haven't controlled their mind and senses don't deserve saintly association. That's what he's saying. And the Kshatriya considers the Brahmin, in general, to be more saintly than himself. That because I'm a king, I'm polluted. I'm tainted by violence and by the struggle for power. And you are aloof from this. You're above this. So you're spiritually more advanced than me. That's always the proper attitude of the Kshatriya toward the Brahmin. So to get the blessings of the Brahmins is what's required to make spiritual advancement. They may be just, you know, ordinary Brahmins. They may not be Paramahamsas. But that's the system. Namo Brahmanyadevaya. Krishna is especially favorable to the cows and the Brahmins. If you serve and worship the cows and the Brahmins, if they give you their blessings, then Krishna will give his blessings. Krishna, you know, will be glad to answer the prayer of the Brahmins that his blessings be bestowed. Okay, then text 7. Again, he's using this word disjya. Disjya means by the grace of providence, by good fortune. Disjya tayanu shishtoham kritascha nugraho mahan apavritai karnarandraya jushta jishtyo shatir giraha. I have fortunately been instructed by you, and thus great favor has been bestowed upon me. I thank God that I have listened with open ears to your pure words. So, seeing the Brahman, you have to be, to see a spiritually advanced person, to even get near such a person, to have the sight of him, you have to be fortunate. To get the dust of their feet, you have to be very fortunate. But you have to be even more fortunate to get useful instructions from them. How do you get instructions out of a saintly person? How do you impel him to, or inspire him to do that? Yes? What's the standard process? Okay, how do you please them? No, but how do you get the instruction in the first place? The question is, how do you get that instruction out of him? Okay, that's one step. That's two. There's three. Tadvidi panipatena parikrashnena sevaya upadikshanti. Then upadikshanti, they'll point out the knowledge to you. Here it is. So tadvidi panipatena, that means dandavat, that means bow down. There's a standard procedure to initiate a dialogue. If you want to be the instructed, you have to first of all acknowledge that I'm the student, you're the teacher. So bowing down shows that you accept a subordinate position. Just like if you want to initiate a telephone conversation, there's a standard protocol, etiquette. You know, I ring you up, you pick up the phone, and it's not proper for me then, I made the call, to say, you know, who are you, what do you want? You know, I called you. So the standard procedure is that the person who answers the phone says hello, to acknowledge that he's picked up the phone, and the person who's calling has to announce, I'm so-and-so, and, you know, I have such-and-such to say. You know, if you don't follow that protocol, it's chaos. There's no useful communication. You know, you pick up the phone, you know, and the person who calls says, well, yeah, who are you? What do you want? It's, yeah, that's leaves the communication. Similarly, there's a protocol. You approach a knowledgeable person and you want instruction. You have to follow a standard protocol to initiate the conversation. First, bow down. You have to acknowledge the roles. Not that, oh, you're a very learned person. I also know a lot. Maybe we can, you know, have an interesting conversation. No. I mean, not that I'm coming to you as an equal or a superior or a rival. I'm not here to argue. I'm here to listen and receive instruction. So the standard way, like picking up the phone and saying hello, or in Japan they say moshi or something, whatever the language is. The standard sign that I am the student and you're the teacher is to bow down and offer obeisances. Then, second step, pariprashnena. Just like the person who made the call, the person who picks up the phone is answering, he says, hello? And then the person who made the call says, I'm so-and-so, and he announces, he explains what his business is. That's his responsibility. Otherwise, there's no discussion, meaningful discussion. So, the second step in the spiritual communication process is pariprashna. You have to ask relevant questions. Don't think it's going to happen by telepathy. Okay, my guru is omniscient. That doesn't mean you don't have to ask relevant questions. Don't assume that it's all going to happen by clairvoyance. You have to evoke from him a response by asking the appropriate questions. Questions about what's really, really on your mind, what your real problem is. Just like if you go to a doctor and you're waiting in the clinic for 2 hours, you finally get a few minutes to see the doctor, but you're ashamed to admit, or you just don't want to admit you're sick. So the doctor asks, well, what's your problem? I have no problem, I'm fine, how are you? Yeah. You're wasting your time and the doctor's time, and the doctor can't even begin to cure you because you don't even, you don't even want to admit or even discuss your symptoms. And you have no time to waste. So like that, the guru has other business too. You have no time to waste. You have to, when you get, you bow down, the guru recognizes that here's a submissive disciple or a submissive person who wants to hear something from me. Here's an opportunity to give instruction. But still, the second step is you have to ask some questions to let the teacher know what you want from him. So the pariprashna, that's the second step. And then, at least in spiritual education, disciples may have many questions, all sorts of problems that they think they have, all varieties of problems. But the answer is one, basically. You're not serving Krishna, you should serve Krishna. You failed, to engage in devotional service, this is your problem. You think it's this and that. But the answer is basically one. You're supposed to be engaged properly in Krishna's service. So therefore, since that's always the answer, the third step is sevaya. If you actually really meant it when you bowed down and asked the question, that you want to get the instructions, then you should be ready to act on the instructions. And since the instruction always basically is the same, serve Krishna, then the third step in spiritual communication is to serve Krishna in general, and to serve Krishna's representatives. So this is the standard protocol for whether it's a kshatriya taking advice from a Brahmin or a disciple being trained up by his Vaishnava guru, whatever, any a person who wants to get knowledge from someone who knows more than him. This is the standard protocol. So again he's saying here, Manu is saying, thank God that you've instructed me. And thank God that I've been able to hear with open ears. Both is required. The guru has to be competent to give the right instruction. But even if he does, if the disciple can't hear, if his ears are not open, if his brain is, he has a merry-go-round going around in his brain and he can't hear anything clearly, then it's still the process doesn't work properly. You have to have a learned, spiritually advanced speaker, but you also have to have a qualified person who's capable of hearing. That's rare. So he said, thank God. Somehow or other, Krishna's given me the intelligence and the sincerity to hear with open ears. Thank God. A Brahmin is respected, revered, basically because of the value of his words. That's what establishes his reputation, his influence in society. Is the value of his words. His words are trusted. He speaks the truth. He doesn't speak nonsense. He doesn't speak vague concoctions. A Brahmin speaks from Shastra. He speaks only from what he has actually realized and what the Shastra says and what the standard authorities say.
Therefore, everybody in the community of all classes naturally want to trust the word of the Brahman. They're very happy to trust his word. And that's the basis of his influence. This is not something that can be instituted overnight, this kind of trust. It has to be earned over a long period of time. In the traditional historical system, when there actually was a Vedic system, even nowadays where there's some vestige of it, people, you know, in India people still respect their parents, they still respect their teachers somewhat. Things are changing, but there's still vestiges of that tradition. Brahmins are respected because, you know, in the community you were brought up, from the practically the day you were born, your life was guided by the Brahmins. The Brahmins told your parents how to perform the samskaras for you, how to bring you up. Your education was given to you by the Brahmins. So therefore, because they took care of you, the Brahmins took, as they have been taking care of you all your life, therefore you trust them. Now, it's not just because it says in the Dharma Shastra you're supposed to trust them, but you experienced it in your own life, from the very day you were born. Therefore it's natural to trust people who have been protecting you, supporting you all your life. The Brahmin is trusted because he actually gives that support. And the people live their lives from their very birth, experiencing that support. And similarly the Kshatriya, the king is trusted because he actually protects the citizens. He actually keeps the society peaceful. So this is, you know, we have to think carefully when we're trying, we want to, you know, manifest this eternal social system in ISKCON. It's not going to be overnight a success. The trust has to be earned over a long period of time. We've seen, you know, someone can seem to be reliable for 10, 15 years and still fail, still go away. So we want to see that we can be supported our whole lives. That's natural, that's fair. Okay. I just want to read one statement from the Manusmriti, four verses, to describe how the Kshatriyas take guidance and they depend on, they're guided properly by the instructions and the blessings of the Brahmins. Okay, I'll read these verses and the translation. It's from the seventh chapter of the Manusmriti. Brahmanan paryupasita pratur uttaya parthivaha trividya vidhan virushas tishtit kesham chashasane vidham chanityam seveta vitram vera virakshuchin virasevi hi satatam raksho bhir api pujyate tebhyo tigache vinayam viditatma api nityashaha Vinitatmahi vitasir nabinashyati karhichit bahavo vinayat nashta rajanat saparichadah vrasta api rajyani vinayat pratipedide. Waking up early in the morning, the king should worship the Brahmins who are learned, wise in the doctrine of the three Vedas. He should remain fixed in their instructions. He should always serve elders and pure Brahmins who know the Vedas. Even the powerful Rakshasas worship one who serves elders. The king should follow his elders humbly, keeping himself always in a humble mood. A king who cultivates humility will never suffer destruction. Many kings were ruined along with their families and entourage because of lack of humility. Even many renounced forest dwellers, on the other hand, obtained kingdoms due to their humility. So we have the examples of Vena Maharaj. He was arrogant, he didn't have any respect for the Brahmins, and they had to finally get rid of him, destroy him. There's also, we know that story. Also, not in the Bhagavatam, but elsewhere, the story of Nahusha. Indra lost his position, was cursed, and had to flee and hide. And the demigods asked the pious king Nahusha, I might be one of the sons of Vaivasvata Manu, I'm not sure. One of the ten sons, Nahusha. And they asked him to become the king of heaven, to take into his place. Among the human beings, he was the most qualified ruler on the earth. And the demigods were so impressed with his capacity, they invited him to become king of heaven. But although he was fit to rule the earth, he wasn't really fit to rule heaven. He didn't really have it in him. He didn't have enough virtue. He became proud. He started insulting the sages. He became lusty after Indra's wife, who was patiently waiting for Indra to come back, that he wanted to take her as his own wife. So this was too much. Yeah. Especially the sages were losing their patience. And Brahaspati was approached by Shachi, the wife of Indra. What am I supposed to do? This Nahusha is making advancements. He wants me to become his wife. Now, what should I do with him? How do I control him? Brahaspati said, okay, you just tell him that you'll accept him. He can come visit you and you'll become his wife. Just tell him that and we'll arrange everything. So she agreed to, on Brahaspati's advice, she pretended to agree to Nahusha's proposal. So you come to my palace, you know, tonight, and I'll accept you as my king, as my husband. So, feeling very arrogant, Nahusha ordered the seven sages, Saptarishis, to carry his palanquin and carry him to the palace of Shachi. Yeah. And anyway, they agreed. They weren't, you know, one of them was short. Who was it? Not Augustine. He was pretty small. Well, one of the sages was shorter than the other seven, so they couldn't carry the palanquin very evenly, and he was getting upset, and it wasn't going very fast. So he was urging them on, you know, walk faster, sarpa, sarpa, faster, walk faster. Sarpa also means snake. So I think it was Augusta Rishi, you know, he finally decided this is too much. And he said, okay, you become a sarpa. Cursed him, and immediately Nahusha fell down and became a serpent snake on the earth. And that was the end of Nahusha's rule as king of heaven. Because of avinayat, because of lack of humility toward the Brahmins and the sages, he was ruined. Okay, I think we're ready for it to start a discussion on the situation of ISKCON. Yes, ma'am. Yes. Tri Kalagya. Yeah, Brahaspati knew what was going to happen before it happened. He didn't have to do anything to make an arrangement. He knew that this was going to happen, that Nahusha was going too far. The sages weren't going to tolerate much more from him. So he just knew in advance. Sages have that power. Just like King Pariksit was cursed to die in 7 days, he didn't make a public announcement. He simply threw off his royal garments and went to the bank of the Ganga and sat down. Still, we hear about 26 sages mentioned by name who all arrived immediately on the spot. Actually, it said elsewhere that millions of sages came, an audience of millions were present to hear the Bhagavatam spoken by Shukadev. But there wasn't any announcement in the radio or the newspapers. You know, they all knew. The sages just knew what was happening by their mystic power. So they have that power to see the present, past, and future. They have what's called yogi pratyaksha, the sensory perception of mystics, which is way beyond ordinary human perception. Okay. Any other questions on this? On these verses? Okay. Can I ask? Here we have basic explanation of how when you have properly functioning Brahmins and Kshatriyas working together, each performing separate functions, human society can function efficiently, peacefully, progressively toward spiritual perfection. This is the ancient Vedic system. It's not intact in the modern world. It's become, in places where there's a shadow of it, that shadow is perverted. In India, it's become perverted into a, you know, corrupt caste system. And other parts of the world,
although it's natural to always have intellectuals, administrators and fighters, you know, productive men and laborers, that you'll have even in a so-called classless society. In the Soviet Union, there were the academics, there were the apparatchiks, the bureaucrats, yeah, and there were the army is always there, and the proletariat. The separate classes are always there, even when you try to abolish them. They cannot be gotten rid of. But it's actually meant to be, the system has to be organized scientifically according to the principles of the Vedas. So the question is, we're, you know, ISKCON is a spiritual organization. Our strength is the holy name and the service of the Vaishnavas. We get our knowledge directly from the Bhagavatam, which doesn't emphasize the Varnashram system. Is it practical? Is it necessary? Is it practical to try to reinstitute this ancient system? A lot of devotees are not attracted to it. They like to continue living their modern life, and they consider this foreign and ancient, and it has nothing to do with their lives. So, you know, first of all, I mean, should this be done? Can it be done? Anybody want to say something? And then how? But that's the second question.
Question about this,
but I don't know what's going on. Well, let's just, you know, play it by ear.
There's something, at least in the, there's something going on there that didn't work out so good as far as this goes.
Yes.
So, is it possible, this is a very clear outline of what should happen.
Yes.
Is there some kind of understanding
I don't think it's been studied clearly and systematically. It should be. What's your idea? What's happened? I haven't been in North America for 6 years.
Or any other ISKCON in the past that have done specifically
in America. Okay, can I share it with you? Some historical background?
Yeah, the second week of joining, I got brought by the instructions, the Jyotin Bhattacharya, the Chancellor of the Vrindavan Mosque of Varnashram Father. The second week of joining, it was just by accident. Actually, nobody was talking about Varnashram, it was like 15 years ago. And I immediately took to that and I realized Prabhupada has the answer. This is what needs, this is required in society. This is the solution for social problems and spiritual problems. So I started looking at this time in terms of what Prabhupada was doing in these basic instructions from the very beginning of the last 15 years. And it's been, through that filter of knowledge and analysis. And it's just the problems we have and the history we have is all about not applying these principles. For example, I have to hear Prabhupada, we've got an issue every single day, between the temple president. He's a chef that people give him from all angles, physiologically, psychologically, astrologically, he's a chef. And I visited him when he began his service. And the first thing he says, for MovieCon, I'm here, they put me here, I have no training, I have no one to guide me, there's no manual, there's nothing. You realize what you can do, the lack of training. And secondly, he didn't have the culture to his guidance. In the sense that the value of tiny moments here is to guide me. I mean, someone here who's more intelligent than me, or whether or not, even if they're as intelligent or whatever, I just need another party to look at what I'm doing and give me feedback and give me guidance on my mind. And because of that, he made mistakes and he fell from his position, he lost his position. And we've been discussing in the last couple of months and minutes. And you know, basically he received it. And I said, well, then you left training, you left guidance. And so he's frustrated. He says, you know, I thought I was a chef here, and I realized I was just an educated student, and that doesn't include it. So no, he has the potential, but that's the fact that without the training, you're a student. And that's the realization is very active. So to encourage those people, and he's a very optimistic, positive thinking, you know, he's a shepherd. He has
but to get them to go back and to take the training and to, you know, to have confidence and faith that he can be trained and actually be successful, he's already failed.
Yes.
Crazy. He's allowed this bottle, this Shakya bottle, has been, you know, or his, you know, his confidence in himself has been shaken. I think that's the movie.
So you're making basic points about lacking what's needed is training and actual ongoing support. Yeah.
You mentioned that the Bhagavatam is still
the top of your focus of the Bhagavatam, not much in it, yeah, but, yeah. Just like I tried to think today of example. I'm sorry to interrupt you. I tried to think today of examples of kings interacting with Brahmins and becoming strong because I couldn't think of many examples in the Bhagavatam. Bhagavatam doesn't get into those issues.
Yes. Yes.
Well, for Brahman to be independent, he has to be supported freely by charity. He can't be a paid servant of the institution.
So then that means the
Vaishnava system has to be set up economically so that Brahmins are maintained. You know, they don't have to beg, they don't have to become anybody's employee, they just, everyone takes care of them freely, and they have no strings attached.
In modern age,
Right, but if the society wants to have any live Brahmins, they'll have to feed them.
Yeah.
Yeah, otherwise the Brahmin will all go into management. If you don't take care of them, then they're going to look for an emergency situation where nobody's allowed to. This is an emergency situation we're in. ISKCON nowadays, nobody is allowed to simply function as a Brahmin. If you're smart, if you're competent, you'll be pushed into management. Yeah. That's, it shouldn't be like that.
It seems that nobody wants to listen to somebody speaking voluntarily.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
That's natural. I mean, it's not that we should outlaw the mode of passion. It has its place. The king, the rulers are also needed. And it's natural for people to admire the rulers and follow them. That's just human psychology. But the rulers have to support a class of men who can speak freely.
If the rulers are looking for the Brahmins, people are being given advice from the simple people, the actual Brahmins.
The problem is the rulers have to support the Brahmins, but first the Brahmins have to create the Kshatriyas. Yeah, this is the problem. Brahmins have to be created out of nowhere in a vacuum.
I guess to his question also our political culture in ISKCON has been not focused on this trend. They see that the necessity, and although all the GCs and all that, the serving the GCs right now, for instance, and even amongst the conversations,
I'm daydreaming, but I'm not doing anything.
Well,
I mean, I think I'm
anyway,
by myself, I can't do anything.
How many of our Brahmins in society see that as their duty to do whatever they're
doing? Well, it takes, normally it requires support, encouragement, and support for anybody to go out on a limb like that. Anybody else have something to say on these matters? Yeah.
No, what I understand from the examples from the traditional faith system is that it all depends on the qualifications.
Yes.
Some kinds of Brahmana, they have qualifications.
Yes.
Yes. And then also, in a certain kind of Brahmana describes that, I said it before, that Prabhupada explains that this balance of Brahmana can only take place amongst human beings and spiritual qualities. And then also, like in the last third point, it's explained how the spiritual master, like Brahma, right, and his qualities, and he knows the nature of the particular man. He says he's knowing the ability of the particular man. He thinks he's frustrated by his tendency to act in close respect. So then the Brahma is actually to see the qualities and make the train. So then, as we say, we start with Brahmanas, the qualified Brahmanas. And they were about all training, all that, no description. But I understand from the philosophy that this, by practicing the course of service, we develop and develop this qualities of moral goodness. But then it also takes time before we
Yeah, if we just continue the way we are, eventually, you know, we'll get everything together. But in the meanwhile, if we just continue the way we're going, we'll lose a lot of devotees and we'll fail to engage many others who could be engaged, you know, who can't directly participate in ISKCON because they, you know, they can't surrender to it. So I think something has to be done. I mean, we could go on the way we're going and somehow we'd muddle our way through eventually, but at a great human cost, and we lose a lot of individuals that we have and fail to get others that we could get. So I think that's why Prabhupada is pushing for this, you know, that it's something practically needed to train, you know, to make Prabhupada, you know, first thing is institute a Varnashram college in every temple. You know, basic idea there is training, education is what's required. Everyone's mentioning it, you know, that what's required is training. Brahmins and Kshatriyas can't just function by instinct, they have to be trained. Yes, yes.
So, yeah, everybody
would be certainly all training, but all the training is to train some of these Brahmins. Well, that's certainly the initial purpose of ISKCON, you know, to train up a class of Brahmins. But Prabhupada was also talking later on about other kinds of training also. Training those who also bringing in, engaging people who can't be pure Brahmins also.
Not
everybody's a teacher.
Huh?
Not everybody can be a teacher. Some are going to be servants and some are going to be managers. And to be a teacher is a different function. So why take someone who has the nature of a fighter or an administrator or a worker and tell him he's got to be a teacher? It's not his nature. So yes, we're a Brahminical movement, but not every individual in this life is going to come up to the standard of functioning as a Brahmin. And many fall down because they can't artificially maintain that standard. Yes. Yes. Especially if it's done in the organized way, under the direction of the Brahmins and Kshatriyas, then it's all very effective preaching. All the classes are needed. The Vaishyas and the Shudras are also very much needed. They're honorable, you know, and worshipable. But the Brahmins and Kshatriyas are needed first, and they require much more intense training. It's harder to make Brahmins and Kshatriyas. Vaishyas and Shudras, you can take people with those natures and very quickly engage them properly. So to find Brahmins and Kshatriyas and train them up properly, that takes a lot of thinking and a lot of work.
It seems like one of the key things is the economic situation.
Yes.
Because the Brahmins are sort of free. So what's the economic situation is not now, like that house is going to down.
Well, you know, the priorities hasn't been established. You know, let's support Brahmins. So therefore, the money's not being allocated. Money's there. You know, individuals have money. You know, projects have money. Brahmins are not that expensive. But first of all, the priority has to be set. You know, the demand has to be recognized that we need. We need. To invest in this.
But in the same system as this is Varnashram, in the ashram system, all the brahmacharis are being trained up to be Brahmins, right? They're being trained by the spiritual master.
Well,
Theoretically, all three higher classes become brahmacharis. The businessmen and the, you know, the administrators also get their brahmachari training. Yes. They can all go to the same gurukul, but they'll get different training there. The Brahmins will stay in school longer than the kshatriyas. The kshatriyas will stay in school longer than the vaishyas. Well, our Harinam and Upanayanam, two initiations, Prabhupada's pretty strict. You take the initiation when you're ready to take and maintain the vows. So someone who can chant 16 rounds and follow the four regular principles, there's a good risk that he can do that. That only that person should be given initiation. That's our standard. That should have been our standard all along. We shouldn't be giving out initiation wholesale to those who are bad risks, who are likely not to follow the principles, or who have never been told what the principles are. I think that has to continue, because that's Prabhupada's policy on Vaishnava initiation. I don't think we're free to play around with that too much, to change, you know, to institute new kinds of initiation or change it, you know. Just like in the Gaudiya Math, as far as I understand, Bhakti Saraswati conceived of first and second initiation a little bit different than Prabhupada. First initiation was not really a full initiation. I know the current Gaudiya Math is like this. I think Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati also didn't give a new name to first initiates. And it was given out more freely to even those who were not really fully committed. And the committed disciples were recognized as actual disciples, given a name in the second initiation. And that was considered a serious vow. But Prabhupada made first initiation just as important. You know, you're a full-fledged disciple from first initiation. But that was part of the program. I don't think we can change back, you know, to the more traditional system. I don't think we can modify it too much without deviating from others by doing it.
Okay.